The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. I know we say it every week, but thank you very much for listening, for subscribing, if that's what you do, for rating it highly and for letting people know about the show. I know when I ask you to do that, we get a big response, and the number of listens we've seen, particularly during this pandemic, has absolutely skyrocketed. So thank you very much. We do appreciate that. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about how human emotions actually leave proper scars on the heart and how true love can actually kill. If you'd like to contact us on the show, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me via Skype are Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
You told him.
I told him I won't marry Loras Tyrell. I told him I'm staying right here with Tommen. With you. I don't choose Tywin Lannister. I don't love Tywin Lannister. I love my brother. I love my lover.
That is the very beautiful Lannisters, brother and sister from Game of Thrones, who were indeed inbreeding, which links us to our first story. Lara.
Happy Saturday to anyone who hasn't been talking about incest and inbreeding this morning, I suppose. So this is actually an absolutely fab story, and another one that I love because it's come out of researchers in Trinity. Dr. Lara Cassidy is the main author. And not only was this published in Nature, it was also the front cover of Nature only 2 days ago. So it is just absolutely brilliant for Irish researchers to be doing such groundbreaking work. And what it is they were looking at the DNA of Mesolithic and Neolithic people. So they only had two samples of Mesolithic. So a lot of the research is based on Neolithic, which were the people who were around the time that Newgrange was built, which is approximately 5,000 years ago. And what they found in the Newgrange monument itself is DNA from an individual that demonstrates that that person was a product of incest. Now, they know that it's a first degree relative. So it could be like your Lannister pals there, a brother and a sister, or it could be a parent and a child. But they know it's that close in terms of the relationship of the parents. And just as it is today, incest was abhorred throughout history. And it's because of the consequences of it. There are an awful lot of extremely negative consequences to incest, and the children born from such are often very significantly disabled. And the reason this is so fascinating is because they believe, as it was in ancient Egypt or ancient Hawaii or the Aztec civilization, that this indicates that there was a ruling class, an almost sort of demigod-like hierarchical class 5,000 years ago in Neolithic Ireland, which is just absolutely fascinating. The other thing they found is that bodies found as far away as County Down had very similar DNA and were likely related to these bodies in Newgrange, which is also fascinating. This is 5,000 years ago, and these are huge distances for people to travel. So it really indicates that there was this hierarchical ruling class all those years ago. They also found from the DNA that it's more likely these people ate a lot of meat compared to the other people that were alive. And again, that adds to the idea of hierarchy.
Are you saying the fact that this person was born of incest, are you saying that is an indicator that they were part of a hierarchy or a king?
Kingdom, exactly. Royalty? So in standard civilization, incest doesn't happen. And like I said, it doesn't happen for a very good reason. And it's hard to understand exactly why certain people are buried in such big and important tombs. You would assume immediately that they were someone of higher importance in the society.
Right. Okay. But then so it's this the tomb. It's nothing to do with the DNA.
No, it's the tomb and the DNA, because it's further evidenced by the incest. Incest isn't something that happened in general populations. It's something that specifically the ruling classes did to try and, I suppose, in inverted commas, keep it in the family. So it's the kind of thing that only really ruling classes and hierarchical royalty did. And it's a combination of all those things, as well as the diet. Fascinatingly, they also found the first evidence of a Down syndrome child. They believe it was dated from around 3,600 BC, so nearly more than 5,500 years old, an infant boy who passed away, but it's the first or the earliest evidence of a Down syndrome child.
With regard to the incest, What in the DNA would tell you that? I thought you got half from your mom and half from your dad. And once they're you know, they're mixed in a person, I don't know how you would know that that was the result of incest.
So if you think about it, if you get half from your mom and half from your dad, if your mom is also your sister, then half of those are also going to be the same as the half that you're inheriting. So you're going to have essentially 75% of your chromosomes are going to be from one person further back, and 25% are going to look different, if that makes sense.
No, it does. But what I'm saying is, without having the parents' DNA, how do they identify that?
Well, you match it to each other so that the person themselves will have chromosomes that are, so for instance, 23 of their chromosomes should be completely different, but they won't be. They'll be the same as half of the, you know, it's sort of like, say, sort of, what's half of 23? Oh my God, 11-ish chromosomes from one
11-ish,
side will be
really?
The same.
Is that the answer there? 11-ish,
I
is
know.
It?
God, that degree in genetics seems so long ago. Can we say baby brain? Do I get away with that?
It's been a while now.
I know.
Okay, that's very cool, and there's a great bit of history in that, and of course it's an incredible site for Ireland, so it's lovely to be on the front cover of a very prestigious journal with some really interesting DNA stuff from that time. I mean, do we know what the population of Ireland, I know you probably, this is probably putting you on the spot now, but do you know what the population of Ireland was 5,000 years ago?
I don't know, to be honest, it's a hard one to know, and I don't think anyone does know. What they do know is that the Mesolithic people were hunter-gatherers about 8,000 years ago, and then when these people, these Neolithic people, came in, they came in from probably Britain, and they look like they wiped out the Mesolithic people, so the population almost started afresh again 5,000 years ago, but I don't actually know the overall population, I'm afraid.
Right. I know, I googled it as Lara was talking, it's about 100 to 200,000 people, so not a lot.
Right. Fair enough. So unsurprising that there might be a bit of interratability between the County Down bodies and the bodies found in this tomb. Really interesting. Shane, our second story has to do with dark matter.
Yeah, so listeners will be familiar with this idea that we know that approximately 80% of the mass of the universe is unaccounted for. So we know it's there, but we can't detect it. So we hypothesize that there are particles out there that we just can't see. And there have been many experiments going for the best part of a decade to detect one of these particles. And recently, some experimental data has arisen in Italy using one of their detectors. And it's mysterious. So I guess this article comes with a grain of salt. It hasn't been published yet, but it's in that it's in the peer review process as we speak. So they have detected a signal that's above the background noise of their detector, and they're trying to figure out if that signal is a very faint hint of dark matter, which would be very cool if it is.
What would that mean?
Well, it would mean for the first time that they have detected a particle of dark matter, so that they would be able to see how it fits in with something called the Standard Model, which is physicists' best guess at the interaction of all known particles and forces except for gravity, the bit that we can't fit into the Standard Model. So it would be confirmation of a hypothesis that physicists have had. Now, there has been some skepticism around this finding. And it's carried out by a group of physicists called particle physicists. So they're looking for this particle. And I've noticed a lot of interaction on Twitter from astrophysicists saying, like, really, the particle physicists are, you know, perhaps they're getting desperate after a decade of looking for this particle. They've not found any conclusive proof for it. And they're sort of getting excited at any anomaly in their data that comes up. So I suppose I should explain to you what they've actually seen. So they have this big tank of a liquid called xenon buried deep below the surface in Italy. And this tank is able to detect particles that it's going through it. Now, they bury it deep in the ground to cut out a lot of background. But still, there are sort of a lot of background particles going through this tank, things like neutrinos and other well-established and well-known particles. When a particle goes through this tank, it gives off a flash of light, and that's a signal. And they've been able to account for the vast majority of particles that are going through, as well understood and well known. And they're basically, after seeing in their data, more signals than the background noise. So they kind of have an unexplained number of signals. So it could be three things, right? It could be this new particle. It could be the dark matter signal. It could also be just statistical fluctuation. Or it might be that our understanding of the existing particles hasn't been as accurate as we thought it is.
Which would be very uninteresting. That would be the least interesting.
It would, exactly. So each of these is equally probable, and that's the issue, right? Mm. So whilst dark matter may be an option, science doesn't go like that. It doesn't go, well, it's probably one of the three. Should we just go with it? You know, they have to find more.
They need more sigma.
Significant evidence.
We need a bigger sigma. Very good.
Yeah, so we need 5 sigma for this to be a new discovery. They've only about 3.5 for the dark matter one, which is not great.
Sigma being sort of seems to be overly complicated metric for the confidence physicists have in a particular number or finding.
Absolutely.
Our third story has to do with the spider that lurks around Ireland, and for a long time we thought was totally harmless.
Yeah, so this is it kind of gives me even shivers talking about it. I'm not a big spider fan, and I shouldn't admit that, because they are absolutely wonderful for the environment. But the idea that we don't have anything venomous in Ireland isn't true. So in about 1998, we reckon, these false widow spiders, or noble false widows as they're called, came in from most likely the Canaries, and probably in plants or something like the bananas. And they have absolutely taken over Ireland, essentially. They're pretty much one of the most common spiders now found in urban areas. They actually live for around 5 to 7 years, and normal house spiders live about 1 to 2 years. And they also, oh God, again, it gives me the shivers, they can produce about 200 babies every 3 to 4 weeks. So this is largely throughout the sort of spring and summer months. But it just, they are a prolific animal. And this really interesting research that came out of the NUI Galway from Dr. Michelle Dugan and also Dr. John Dunbar there, and was just published in the journal Toxins. And they examined through proteomics all the different proteins that are in the venom of these false widow spiders. And what they found is, out of 140 parts or proteins in the venom, 111 of them are also found in, I suppose, in inverted commas, the actual true black widow spiders, which everybody is terrified of, including a thing called the alpha latrotoxin, which is known to disrupt central nervous system of vertebrates. So we are vertebrates. So it's kind of worrying to think that these spiders, which are now endemic in Ireland, have a much stronger venom than we thought they had. And the important thing to remember is that even spider bites from actual black widows very rarely require medical attention. And likewise for false widow spiders, they rarely require medical attention, but they can be searingly painful. And they can also cause severe reactions at times. They can cause stiff limbs for long times afterwards. But they're not an aggressive spider. So it's generally if they get caught up in bed clothes. Again, I'm getting shivers down my spine, but if they get caught up in bed clothes.
Why would you say bed clothes? Like, why would you do that to people?
But it is true. It is true. And also if they get caught up in your own clothes, a poor lady in Waterford got bitten because one ran up the inside of her jeans and she ended up in hospital for 6 days. I know.
A false widow.
Now what happens is, you see, she actually got cellulitis. So it was probably bacteria on the venom, on the spider's fangs, that actually caused her to become ill. But it is just important to note that these are venomous spiders. The advice from NUI Galway, from the Venom Systems Lab there, is to avoid them. They say don't kill them because you could mistake them for a harmless house spider. But if you do get bitten, you need to get that spider, whether it's dead or alive, and you need to get a photo of it. And you need to send it to them there in the Venom Systems Lab in NUI Galway, and also draw a circle around the bite to make sure that the red part isn't expanding. That would be the best advice. And if you're worried, call your GP.
Circle around the red part so it doesn't get bigger and bigger.
Exactly.
Actually, that's not going to stop it getting bigger and bigger, but it helps you monitor it. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
If it's that easy.
Monitor it. Just about it.
They say being a docker is hard. Just draw a circle around it.
Just draw a circle around it, you know, magic marker.
Our final story is an unusual one, Shane, and it's to do with the aliens.
Yeah, so people may be familiar with this Drake equation that was published in the 1960s, where a scientist called Drake worked out the likelihood of there being other civilizations in the Milky Way. So this is you can just plug in any number for the estimates of the different factors, and you can come out with an answer from zero to a few billion. So this work, which has been published in the Astrophysical Journal from a University of Nottingham, has sort of tried to have another go at the estimate, putting in, as they see it, more accurate estimates for the different factors. So they've refined the equation. They've come out with a result that says there's something between 4 and 211 civilizations in the Milky Way today capable of communication with another planet. And they said that 36 civilizations is the most probable from their calculations. They note that their model is conservative, but other physicists have said, look, how can you say 36 with any level of certainty? There's just so much variation.
I'm feeling very Sigma Zero right now.
Yeah, so the same physics skeptic that I follow on Twitter, who was talking about my first story, she was really going to town on this one, saying like, well, how does this stuff get published? But yet it does. It's kind of cool though, and it's very interesting to use something called Fermi problems in physics. So I do this with students all the time. I'd ask them, how many piano tuners live in Dublin? Using your wits, can you figure that out? And can you make an estimate of that? However, these sorts of problems depend on you having some level of understanding of the factors that go into it. So if I said, how many piano tuners are there? You can guess, well, how many people, how many pianos, etc. If I say to you, what's the lotto number is going to be tonight? Then it's a random guess. So there's no way you can narrow that down.
Yeah.
And so the Drake equation is somewhere in the middle of those two things. So what they have looked at is the likelihood of there being civilizations on a planet where they would live for a couple of thousand years, assuming that most exoplanets that are Earth-like have the capability of a biological existence on it. So they're assuming that any other Earth that's out there will probably have life on it, which is a huge assumption to make, but they're making that assumption.
Even if we don't have the correct answers to hand, making educated guesses and improving on our guesses with new information, that the so-called Bayesian method, can sometimes produce surprisingly accurate results. And this mathematics, although it might sound like plucking things out of the air, maybe it is a bit more in this case, I find that really interesting. I always thought that you had to have all of the pieces of the puzzle to be able to make the puzzle, but actually turns out you don't. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Just for anyone who's at home wondering about how many piano tuners there are in Dublin, I just Googled it and I got 1.6 million results. So logic says there's 1.6 million piano tuners in Dublin. So I know I'm right.
Can you stop Googling things in the middle of these, interview
right?
pieces? It sort of makes me feel like I'm redundant. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Lara Dungan, thanks very much for joining us. That's Al Green there, nursing a pretty intense cardiovascular injury, it would seem. But the Reverend, as he was known, is unlikely to be calling his local doctor anytime soon. But should he? Sandeep Jahar is a cardiologist and author of Heart, A History. He joins me now. You're very welcome to the program, Sandeep. Perhaps you might start off by talking to me a little bit about the structure of the heart to give us a quick biology lesson.
Oh, sure. So the heart has four chambers. There are two collecting chambers and two pumping chambers. The right-sided chambers pump blood into the lungs where the blood gets oxygenated. And then the left-sided chambers transport blood into the body where tissues pick up the oxygen and deoxygenate the blood, which returns to the right side of the heart to be pumped back into the lungs and get oxygenated again. So that's the cycle. It's interesting that, we really only discovered the mechanism of the heart in the 17th century. I mean, basically, this was work done by, William Harvey prior to Harvey, the thought was that blood was consumed by the body. But Harvey, you know, proved that, in fact, the blood is circulated and reused. And that was really one of the great scientific advances.
And it is this way that we've sort of thought about the heart for quite some time, literally a mechanical pump in the body. So why do you think we associated it with emotional feelings? We talk about, you know, tales of the heart, for example. Why has that sort of link between emotion and heart existed when, as you describe it, it sounds like a mini engine?
Right. Well, the mini engine paradigm came later. Really, the heart was associated with love and the emotions from antiquity. You know, the Greeks thought of the heart as the soul, the center of the soul, the repository of the emotions. You know, that conception of the heart really, you know, continued through human history until, you know, basically until William Harvey and even, you know, considerably after that. I mean, I think that that conception of the heart as an emotional object really retarded scientific progress, especially when you consider the progress that we've come to take for granted, the technologies like the heart-lung machine and so on. The idea has always been, well, the heart is the seat of the soul. How could it be replaced by a man-made pump? So the sort of emotional connotations associated with the heart have really been present in human history for millennia. What's interesting and what I write about in the book is that there was a transformation from the pre-scientific era, from this connotation of the heart, into a transformation of the heart into a machine, a pump, that has, you know, physical properties. But what I argue in the book is that we really today need to broaden our vision of what the heart is, that the heart is, in fact, an emotional object, that our emotional lives are written on our hearts. And there's a lot of evidence to show that the pump really responds to our emotional lives.
You said something curious there. You said that emotions shape our heart. Did you mean that metaphorically, or do you mean actually physically?
Well, I mean it, well, both really, but the stronger association really today is with the physical. So we know today that emotional distress can actually change the shape of our hearts. It's a fascinating syndrome that has been variably termed Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, or in sort of common parlance, the broken heart syndrome. And what happens is that, well, for reasons we don't fully understand, in situations of emotional distress, like after the death of a spouse or after a romantic breakup, the heart can balloon into a extraordinarily defective shape called a Takotsubo. A Takotsubo is actually a special pot that's made in Japan that's used to trap octopus. And so and this phenomenon was first described in Japan and they called it Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. Cardiomyopathy just means heart disorder. And so this is something that we are seeing more and more often. I see, you know, probably, well, at our hospital, I would imagine close to 100 cases a year. That's just at one hospital.
I'm sorry, I needed to stop you there. You're saying that after the death of a loved one or a really emotional event, that the heart can actually sometimes change shape to result in people dying from it?
Absolutely. So let me give you an example. I had a patient of mine whose husband had recently died. After he died, actually, she was obviously grieving, but maybe even a little bit relieved, according to, you know, from her own words, because he had had a very long illness. He had dementia. But a week after the funeral, she looked at his picture and became tearful. And then suddenly her heart started to race. She developed chest pain, started to pant. She came to the hospital. We did an ultrasound, and her heart had ballooned into this Takotsubo shape. And its function had decreased to less than half its normal, you know, value. So the pumping capacity of her heart had dropped to less than 50%. And she had these really profoundly abnormal symptoms, shortness of breath, swelling of the legs. But after her emotional state had normalized, about a week later, we did another ultrasound, and her heart had returned to its normal functional shape. So wow. This is something that we see a lot. And you know, in most cases, like with my patient, the heart does return to normal and the patient survives. But there are plenty of cases that we see where the patients develop life-threatening arrhythmias, congestive heart failure like my patient, and sometimes even die. So a broken heart is yes, metaphorically harmful, but it's also, in actuality, a life-threatening condition. I should also add that chronic emotional distress that comes from having a, difficult relationship with a spouse or, a significant other or your children or just being profoundly lonely. All these things over time can also affect the heart in extremely deleterious ways.
Is this the same as so-called voodoo death? Because there were certainly these stories I'd read about, and I wasn't sure where the science lay on it, of people being cursed or these sort of prophecies being fulfilled and people dying on the spot. Is there any evidence to say that this might be the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to some work that was done by anthropologists and Walter Cannon, who was a Harvard physiologist, advanced an explanation of this phenomenon whereby, people who felt that they had been cursed, such as by a voodoo doctor, could sometimes develop such profound emotional distress that they would drop dead right on the spot. And Walter Cannon postulated, and data has now come to confirm this idea, that profound emotional distress can lead to such an activation of your sympathetic nervous system that blood vessels constrict to such a degree that blood volume, the volume of blood available to your heart, drops so significantly that massive disruption in oxygen delivery can result in organ damage and sudden death. So this is a phenomenon that's been known about for a very long time, and the irony is that native peoples like Australian Aborigines had this sense of it probably even before modern people did.
The research that you talk about, this is all humans, right? Yeah. Can this effect be seen in animal studies?
Yeah, I mean, these kinds of things have even been seen in animals. This is one of my favorite studies, was a study published in Science, the one of the premier journals of research in 1980, I believe. And researchers took rabbits and they fed them all a very high cholesterol diet to see the effect of cholesterol on the development of vascular disease. And they found, surprisingly, that some rabbits developed more heart disease than others. And they didn't know why. they thought it might have something to do with how often the technician delivering food interacted with the rabbits, but they weren't sure if that was the reason or if it was air circulation or whatever. So they then divided the rabbits into two groups. Both groups were fed a high cholesterol diet. In one group, the rabbits were removed from their cages, talked to, petted, played with, loved, and then returned to their cages daily. And the other group of rabbits were isolated in their cages and largely left alone. And they found on autopsy that the rabbits that were loved, that had human interaction, had 60% less aortic disease than the rabbits that were isolated. So that also, I think, speaks to the idea of the effect of emotional isolation on our bodies. And we know now the profound effect of loneliness on both heart disease and brain disease. But we don't always think that, you know, animals, need that, are built or evolved for needing that kind of connection, but they really are. You know, it's so important, and study after study has shown this in humans. Let me just mention one more, the Whitehall studies, which was conducted in Britain of British civil servants. The civil servants who were sort of on the bottom of the hierarchy had much more disease and early death than those on the top. So porters, for example, had much more disease and much worse survival rates than those who had desk jobs. Now, the speculation, is that job autonomy, occupational autonomy, the idea that you have some control over your workplace, that idea is so important for maintaining health. It's not just what you do or how much exercise you have, but it's also, how you think about your job, how you conceptualize it. And Sir Michael Marmot from Britain has done some amazing work in this area, and he actually conducted the Whitehall studies. And he has said that, the civil servant who doesn't have control over their work and they don't feel connected to their work, they have situations that can cause profound emotional distress, chronic distress over time that can result in death.
Well, the book is called Heart, A History. The author is Sandeep Jahar. Sandeep, thanks very much for joining us. So time to look back at some of your emails and texts from last week. As Aid mentioned at the beginning of last week, it was a repeat because I broke my hand. I was cycling in the Wicklow Mountains and I slid on some wet road and I broke my metacarpal and snapped my fifth finger, my baby finger, in two. And it was extremely painful. But on top of that, I wasn't wearing gloves. And I normally wear gloves. And I went looking for the gloves in the morning. And I was looking at the time and I was like, I better get out. I couldn't find the gloves. I found one. And so I said, oh, screw it, I'll leave it. My finger's mangled as a result. I should have just looked for the gloves and worn them. So be careful on the roads, folks, because one thing that really stuck with me was the waste of effort and time that goes into fixing someone's stupid mistake, like all the time in A&E and people's, important and brilliant consultants and doctors and nurses' time. I just felt like a bit of an idiot, even though it was in a simple enough accident. But be careful. I think it would be no harm to do a sort of a public service announcement and say it costs this amount of money and wastes this amount of time of yours and others to fix somebody. Why don't we be a little bit more careful out in the roads, shall we? I think that would be good. I think people are feeling of civic enough duty at the moment that they might actually be more careful because they don't want to waste people's time. Certainly that's been the case for COVID, people not wanting to go into the hospital and bother the staff. So anyway, that's why it was a repeat last week. Not that I got any sympathy whatsoever from any of you, I might add. I was expecting a pouring in of sympathies, flowers, texts and calls, possibly some chocolates, some food sent to my home, but that did not happen. So you know who your friends are. So to your texts and tweets, last week we did this episode on perception and reality, and it was quite a mind bender. We were talking about, you know, how apples don't actually exist. We perceive them, but they're not actually there. It's just atoms and energy, which is just such a crazy idea. Every time I think about it, someone says, how come we all see that same apple that doesn't exist? Well, we all perceive that movement of energy that is an apple. In the same way, we've evolved that ability because it's useful for us to do that, to see that state of matter and energy as an apple, and to taste it as an apple. That's useful. And another person says, has to be one of the best programs on radio. Great interview with Don Toffin. Thank you very much for that. The week before, we were talking about COVID dreams and got a number of your comments on it. We were asking, do you have dreams during lockdown that are related to the pandemic or anything like that? One says, I had a dream. I was in town one day doing many important jobs. I walked into a coffee shop and noticed I wasn't wearing socks or shoes. Then I woke up. What was going on? That's from Shane and Tala. I don't know. I mean, we're not one of those late night shows that promises to analyze your dreams for money. But I don't know. Maybe the not wearing shoes or socks is kind of like walking into a place without a mask. I mean, this is the problem if you extrapolate dreams to suit your narrative. This is what I was saying to our guest last week. I just wasn't fully convinced. Anyway, another says, I think people have reported more dreams during lockdown because it was the first time in years they got to sleep properly. Proper REM sleep equals more dreams. During normal life, a lot of people make do with 5 or 6 hours of sleep, which is not nearly enough for most people. The alarm clock goes off before people get into the REM sleep cycle, so no dreams to remember. That's actually a good point. I hadn't thought about that actually the amount people are supposedly dreaming may actually have to do with the fact that they're sleeping at all. Another says, the most common dreams I have is being somewhere and coming out of my car, coming out and my car is gone. Also being in a hotel and not being able to find my room. Can you please ask your expert, what does this mean? Again, we were asking whether or not you'd had COVID dreams. We are not offering a dream interpretation service on the program. I remember doing a talk show called The Spin for Spin 103.8 in my early radio days. And one of the things that we started out, you know, we did regularly because it's good radio, is we would ask people about their dreams and we'd have someone on and they would be like a mystic who would interpret dreams. And they would have various levels of claims of how scientific or how authoritative they were, but it was all bullshit really. And it was also an opportunity to hear what mad things people dreamt about, which is just interesting in and of itself. But when it comes to the science of interpreting that, we're not doing that. It was one of the first things when I'd been in the job long enough to be able to say, what about not doing this again? It was one of the first things that came up, that and speaking to mediums, which was also a staple of that program. I was like, we're not talking to mediums. They're making it up and it's very harmful. But it is good radio. It's good radio talking to a medium. It's just also unethical, isn't it, really? And it says, I've a recurring dream for 20 years. I'm in a job I was in for a long time. I'm sneaking in and working, but seem invisible to my workmates. Oh, God, what a terrible dream. That's just the worst, isn't it? just going back to work and none of your mates recognize you and you're just back in it. Oh, no. I've never had a recurring dream and I've never been able to control my dreams. I don't think I want a recurring dream. I certainly would love to be able to control my dream. But I do remember, I wrote it down for today for you. I do remember my dream from this morning. I was at my mother-in-law's house, which had transformed into sort of a villa with sort of those sort of Spanish tiles. In a V shape, and I was standing on top of these tiles, and I had a shower curtain for a cape, and I had a a mouth guard like a rugby player would wear. And been below me, about two floors below me, were my friends who were at a sort of a pool party thing. And I clearly climbed up here to impress my mother-in-law as I jumped off her roof and fell, what, 20 feet down and landed in the pool. And I came out and shoved my hands in the air with a V, thrilled with myself, and turned to look at her, and she was not very impressed at all. And I was disappointed. So that was my dream. Maybe we'll do that every week. Maybe we'll just do one dream a week. Let us know what you think of that. And if you did have COVID dreams or had anything to say on this week's program, you can drop us an email, science@newstalk.com. That's it from us for this week's program. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and Simon Keane, who were producing. More Simon than Aidan this week. Aidan was off. And also to Jojo Cardozo, who was on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed over the next coming days. In the meantime, stay curious.